Thank you for your practice. I'd like to feel like the room's more tuned or something, or maybe I'm more tuned. So like many people, many of the people that I've met and many of the people that I know were first introduced to the practice, the Dharma, because they were suffering, because they weren't happy. They were confused, angry, frustrated, just something just didn't seem quite right about life. And so many people come to the practice looking for answers, maybe. I feel very fortunate and very grateful that actually I feel like the Dharma came to me. When I was 19, I was first introduced to the practice. I was first introduced to what we just did, mindfulness of breathing, a practice that I mostly take for granted now. Came to me when I was 19 years old. And when I was 19 years old, I was very unhappy. I was very confused. I had been through a lot of what they now tell me is trauma, traumatic loss. I had many deaths in my life. My sister was killed in a car accident when I was 11. My girlfriend and I were hit by a drunk driver when I was 18 and she was killed. And I just kind of made it out of high school. I didn't really have a lot of what I would call quality relationships. I had maybe one friend that I really, maybe one person that I would actually tell the truth to about my experience. And so when I was introduced to the practice, I was I felt kind of like an old man at 19. I was just like, I wasn't suicidal, but I just was not, my outlook upon life was very dark. It's like, is this just it? Just loss and fear and confusion and suffering? Is this? And I felt like, I said, did anybody else see this? Am I the only person who feels this way? And being introduced to the practice of mindfulness of breathing, what we just did the first time I learned the practice, I was tremendous relief. Tremendous relief, because I had no idea that I could get my attention. I had no idea that there was some way to not be inside my mind all the time. Because I just felt like my mind was just on me 24/7, and it was just anger, fear, and confusion. And I had no idea that there was an option or an opportunity. And I could see that, oh, if I choose to pay attention to my breathing, all of that story kind of just goes away. Of course, I get pulled back in and it comes back online again. It's like a Wi-Fi signal goes in and out, right? You lose it for a minute. Except for this is a good time for the signal to go out. You can be in breathing and sensation. And so immediately, right from the get-go, I was very interested in the practice. I was like, I want more. I also am a recovering drug addict, so I like more of things that feel good. Existentially, that's how I operate. I like feeling good, and I really like feeling better. So actually, I feel like that tendency actually was very helpful at the beginning, because I really was dedicated to meditating and really interested in the practice. You know, and I think that this is common. It's not true for everybody, but for many people, this is kind of how we come in. And then there was you know, I just had dinner with my first teacher, Stephen Smith. Some of you probably know him. He lives in town. Who introduced me to the practice, and I hadn't seen him in many years. And not only did I learn mindfulness of breathing and mindfulness, first foundation of mindfulness, I also learned about the Dharma. I learned about the First Noble Truth. And when I heard about the First Noble Truth, which is typically translated as, from this Pali word, dukkha, that does not translate into English very well. But it means something like unsatisfying, stress, pain, difficulty. Its most common translation is suffering, which is a pretty, for Western mind, a pretty negative, pessimistic word. But for me, I was like, yeah, suffering, I got it. I got a fucking PhD in human suffering, and I'm only 19. So sign me up for Buddhism. You know? And so what that did for me, the way that Stephen explained it to me, was that actually because of the loss in my life, because of the tragic loss of my sister at 11 and nobody really talking to me about that, because of this tragic death and this loss of this girlfriend that I had, and seeing her and having to discover the dead body and like run to the police station, and the trauma of that experience, is that my heart was ripped open to the reality of suffering. You know, and I wasn't the first human being to have seen that. This is the world that we live in. You know, so I was taking it all very personally. Why is this happening to me? Why are the bad things happening to me? Very self-centered view. And it very normalized it. It was like, no, this is how it is, actually. This is how it is for everybody. Now, not everybody has the same experiences, and we all have our experience and our memories and our losses and our sadness and our pain. I'm sure you all have that. I'd be very surprised if there's somebody in this room who doesn't know what I'm talking about. We all have this. And so it shifted my perspective. It gave me kind of a big release in my view of like, oh, this is like I'm, of course I'm suffering. You know, based on the evidence, based on my, you know, life's history, suffering would be a very appropriate response for what you've been through. But up until then, I didn't have any tools, I didn't have any understanding, I didn't know what to do with it, so I just suffered about it. I suffered about my suffering, I suffered about my loss. Why me was a big one for me. Why do bad things happen to me? And so initially I had this big experience. And so learning mindfulness and learning about the Four Noble Truths and learning about, you know, kind of what the Buddha was talking about. And I believe the Four Noble Truths are a meditation practice. They're not, typically they're taught as kind of the Buddhist dogma, right? This is the orthodox of Buddhism. But really the Four Noble Truths are a meditation that the Buddha is saying, notice this. Do you see this? You know, there's a Pali word called anapasako, which means something like, come and see for yourself. And all of the teachings are rooted in this idea, come and see for yourself. Come and see. Come and have a look. Look inside your experience. What do you see? Do you see dukkha? If you see dukkha, you're seeing clearly now. And it's so tricky for us because I want to get away from all that. I don't want to see that. My whole life, I'm running on the pleasure-pain dichotomy, chasing after pleasure, trying to get away pain. The last thing I want to see is dukkha. The last thing I want to do is deal with my loss and my suffering and my sadness. I want to get away from that. And this practice says you need to sit in that. You need to turn towards that. That which you already know is true anyway. And all of the denial strategies we get into, and all of the ways we like to turn and look the other way, and all of the ways we don't want what's true to be true. Right? We want to pretend. And the practice is about going actually towards that. And we don't want to do that. And so what that puts us in this very odd place of what I call the relationship between internal mindfulness and external mindfulness, or the reality of what we would call in a clinical environment, affect and response. Meaning that life has had an affect on me. I've been so much affected by the world, right? I've been affected by people, places, things, memories. Life has had a tremendous affect on me. And so I need to embody that, I need to understand that, I need to be honest about the difficulties in my life. But that's only half the job. That's what we call wisdom. Mindfulness, clear knowing, sometimes called clear comprehension. Clearly seeing that which is difficult. And then this compassion that I want to talk about from here on out is how do I respond to that? What am I bringing to the table? I was bringing why me to the table. And I can tell you that didn't work very well. You know, so it's like we arrive in this reality of the First Noble Truth. We arrive in the reality in the knowing that life is not always what we would like it to be. Where's the compassion? Where's the empathy? How much do you really care about your sadness? How much do you really care about your loss, your fear, your broken heart? All of these things, what do we do with them? When do we do something with them? Compassion. Now, this is the antidote. Compassion destroys ill will. It destroys hatred. It destroys fear. It literally destroys those qualities. And so we're actually, to some extent, I feel like it's a call to action. It's a response. It's kind of a stand up for yourself. It's the wise response. And you know, being in America and teaching mindfulness in America and the U.S. is that the West, maybe we could say, is such a culture of knowing. We want to know. We want to be smart. We want to be intelligent. We want to know things. We value knowledge so much. But the role of ethics and compassion and kindness and friendliness, I don't hear so much about those. I knew I was suffering. I had all the information. I just didn't have any way to hold it. And so maybe we would use the word empathy in everyday colloquial English. Empathy. Where's the empathy? You know, in the text, the Pali Canon, the oldest text of the Buddha, he talks about compassion as being a quivering of the heart or a movement of the heart when it comes into contact with pain. My pain or your pain. And we almost know this, right? You ever feel your throat tighten up a little bit? I know this physical sensation when I come into contact with bad news, somebody suffering, suffering of my own. I feel something in my chest. So I think that it's almost a literal way he talks about it. There's a quivering of the heart. There's a movement of the heart. And I didn't really actually start practicing compassion or heart practices till about 10 years after the initial experience I had with mindfulness. So my experience has been mindfulness has been really great and really helpful and totally not enough. It has given me some contentment in my mind, but my heart still continues to ache. And sometimes mindfulness can be almost bad news because once you are aware of the ache in the heart, the more awareness you become more and more and more aware. Because with awareness comes awareness. And so we use these, sometimes they're called Brahma Viharas. I just call them heart practices, I think is the term that makes the most sense to me. And also, too, I think it's important to point out the fact that sometimes we know. I oftentimes find that I actually fall short a lot. A lot of times I find myself in a situation where I know compassion is the right thing. I just am not there yet. Because the truth is, when it comes to these types of experiences, my reaction is not compassion. My reaction is hatred. I hate loss and sadness. I hate it when things don't go my way. I don't like those experiences. I don't like pain. And I think that You know, when the Buddha talks about the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion, I think that we're wired as human beings to hate pain. That's our natural reaction, is get rid of this. And of course, that's physical pain. But when it comes to the emotional pain, the real pain of the heart, I've never been able to hate my experience into being any better than it was. I've tried. Like, it's like, if I just hate this enough, maybe it will go away. And what happens is I lock myself up. I become sort of like the victim and the perpetrator. I become that part of me that's hating, and I also become the part of me that's hated. And I become dysregulated, and my heart races, and I even get sweaty. And in neuroscience, or in terms that we talk about, they call it being dysregulated, emotional dysregulation. Oftentimes is because we have aversion and anger and agitation towards emotional experience that we don't like or that we don't understand yet. I think compassion, of all of the things, of all of the practices, is the most difficult. Especially self-compassion, which is what I want to do for the practice here in a little bit. Is there's something about your pain that's a little bit more tolerable than my pain. Have you noticed? I have a little bit more, you know, if someone of my friends is having a hard time or broke up with somebody or having some challenges in their life, it's easier for me to kind of embrace them and hold them and go, oh, you know, I'm here for you, I care about you, I care about your pain. It's easier. I don't know why. I've noticed it's easier for me. But when it's my own, it's taken a lot of work. I've had to do a lot of daily sitting, retreat sitting, many hours of just trying to come into contact with my heart and just say the simple phrase, I care about you. I see that you're hurting. I see you're suffering. And I care about you. I care about this. And when I first started hearing these kinds of practices, very suspicious. I was like, this sounds like weird hippie shit that they made up in the 70s. I was like, you had me at suffering. When you were talking about the suffering, I was on board. I was in. Now you want me to care about my pain and you want me to be friendly and loving kindness. I don't know about all that. That sounds like Mr. Rogers or something, if you know Mr. Rogers. And so I had a lot of aversion in my mind just towards this idea. I had a lot of like, I'm not doing that. Or it wasn't until I started working with Against the Stream, or really specifically with Noah Levine, when I started working with him personally, and him really encouraged me, saying like, you are lacking the compassion for your suffering. You don't have that. And it was, you know, painfully obvious, also not fun to hear from your teacher. And I spent a couple of years doing this sort of practice every day, and not just compassion, but also loving kindness and forgiveness, of really trying to access my heart to see what it was like if I did that, and then to see if I could sit in that experience of that. Because there's something about it, when it starts to work, it starts to feel kind of raw. Like I noticed that I've been walking a lot here in Chiang Mai, and I had a blister on my foot, and every time I stepped down, it was like, ouch, 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 ouch. It was kind of raw, you know, this raw, right? And I was like, oh, that's exactly what these heart practices are like. Once the heart starts to open, it's like, oh, ooh, ouch. So we want to cover it back up, right? We want to put gauze over it and tape it up. And, right? That's what I want to do. That's what I did to my foot. But it's not how it works. So we have to learn how to go, ah, that hurts. Right? So sometimes it's just that quick, tr- trying it for a moment or a breath that quick. And what starts to happen, what really started to happen for me, especially somebody who has had a lot of experience with anger and hatred. Actually, there was a time in my life, many years in my life, where I thought hatred was noble. I thought that there was something, that there were things in the world that deserved to be hated. You know, oppression and violence, and I was into punk rock music and anti-government and global terrorism and all of this, like, oppression and slavery and, you know, sexism and racism. I had all this, like, reason to hate. And all of the bad things that happened to me. I thought that actually, like, if I softened that actually caring about my suffering was not only foolish but unsafe. And I would be left vulnerable. And we don't like to be vulnerable. I don't. Until we learn how to be vulnerable, and then we start to realize, oh, this is what I've been looking for all along. You know? This is what I've been looking for all along. And so we see that polarization of hatred and compassion, they're polar opposites. And one of the things that really helped me was when I realized actually the reason I hate so strongly is because I care so deeply. Like, I'm really sensitive, actually, person. Like, I really care what you think about me right now. Like, I want you to be enjoying this talk right now. And so, you know, this was kind of good news for me. Because I oftentimes walked around with this attitude of, I don't give a shit about nothing, I don't care. But actually, nothing could have been further from the truth. I cared so much. And I used hatred and anger as kind of a way to protect myself. And so once I was able to kind of let that go and turn back in, I was like, wow, like, I have a lot of compassion. People that you meet in the Dharma, people that, some of the most compassionate people that I've met in traveling in different Dharma circles used to be the most angry people. They care so much. It's like, oh, my wires got crossed, you know? Like, it's like the switch got the wrong direction. And so, you know, as I come back in, as I turn back in, it's like, oh, I get angry because I care. And if something that I believe in gets criticized or attacked, or somebody that I love is being made fun of or ridiculed, if something that I hold as a core value is being attacked, I respond with anger because I want to protect that. We see this play out on the human stage quite a lot. But really what's being asked is this compassion, if it's looking for compassion. And compassion ends suffering. It puts it out. But, you know, evolution did not give us this quality. Actually, I was talking to Steve and my friend Josh the other day about, even in the time of the Buddha, in the Pali word, they didn't really have a word for meditation. It wasn't really called meditation. It was called bhavana, which means to cultivate, metta bhavana, cultivate. So mindfulness, we cultivate awareness. Compassion, we cultivate quality. So we have these seeds of compassion, but they need to be planted in rich soil, which it turns out suffering, dukkha, the shit of life, turns out to be the best fertilizer. Right? When you plant vegetables and herbs and all of these things, don't they grow best in really dark, gnarly, stinky soil? Okay. Same is true for this practice, is that the seeds of compassion grow best when they're planted in that, when we turn towards that which has been painful. So this is something that we don't just agree with. We don't just say, oh yeah, I like what that dude's saying. Cool, like, and that's it. No, these are one of the things I've heard recently that I really like is, you know, we all know who Charles Darwin is, and he's kind of the guy who's famous for the survival of the fittest notion. But actually, he said he had a lot more to say than that. And Charles Darwin said that sympathy is the strongest human inclination. In Buddhism, we would call that sankhara. This, that we are wired really well for sympathy. We're wired to care. But if we're confused, we get angry, we get frustrated, we become hateful. But if we're clear, we have this other possibility. So for me, when I look inside my heart, when I look inside my own direct experience, I find that compassion and hatred are, they're not so different, even though they're polar opposite. So when I come into contact with suffering or pain or anguish or loss, it's like anger wants to jump out first, be like, I got this, like, I got this, I got this. And so I have to learn to kind of hold that. And no, we don't want to do that anymore. That doesn't work. And so slowly as we spend time sitting and cultivating and paying attention and careful attention and trying to eyeball this or keep an eye on this or learn to act from this place of compassion, it becomes a little bit more of a fair race, you know? And many times I'll find myself respond with compassion and be like, hey, well, wow, this shit actually works. Like, I have that now. That's a possibility. And, you know, so it's like, you know, it was something that was earned. It was something that has been cultivated. The seeds were planted in the dark, rich soil, and I paid attention to them, and I watered them. Kept an eye on them and took care of them as best as I could. And these things start to actually grow and thrive, and they start to be more available to us when we need them. I'm also told from a lot of the academic work that I've done in studying early Buddhism that, you know, the time of the Buddha was a very rich agricultural time, and that he was the lineage of the sun, the Sakyans. So he would have been very well aware of things like agriculture, and he would have been very well aware of this type of analogy of seed and fruit. And so he used this cultivation, agriculture analogy in many of his teachings because it's something that we can see in the natural world. We can see it externally. We can see it in plants and trees. And so if we can kind of get that system thinking in our mind, we can take that same analogy and turn it inward. And so what kind of seeds do we plant? Whatever type of seeds you plant is going to end up being the type of fruit that you pick and eat. What kind of food do we want to eat in our hearts and our minds? So this happens slowly over a period of time. It's really hard to track your own progress, right? It's like you could put a seed in the... You could put the best seed in the richest, deepest, darkest soil and sit there and be like, okay. And you'd never actually get to see it because it goes so slow. And you have to record it and speed it up really fast, which is what we'd like to do with our lives, wouldn't we? We don't get to see. But all of a sudden we get to do this stuff and we get to notice, hey, there's a sprout, there's a little tree, there's a sapling over there now. That didn't used to be there. So this cultivation word is what I think works best for us, is if we see it from this perspective. So every time, you know, every time we bring our attention back to the breath, right, we cultivate a seed of awareness, we cultivate a moment of mindfulness. One moment. We come in and we say these phrases. May I be at ease. We cultivate this little seed of loving kindness. So as my good friend Vinny would say, it's time to stop looking at the menu and eat the food. So what I'll invite you to do is to go back and do a meditation posture, and we're going to do a guided meditation on self-compassion. And there'll be time for questions and answers at the end. And so to just set it up in the way that I teach it, because there's no real traditional way to teach metta bhavana. Different people teach them different ways. Some teachers teach them, some teachers don't. I teach compassion as a guided meditation, mostly because I have found it to be extremely helpful in my life. So it's not so different than mindfulness practice, except for that I will ask you to anchor your attention, your breathing attention, on what I call the heart center on this location, and just kind of stay there. That's your anchor. And we'll use phrases. We'll say phrases internally. So you can still be mindful of the body, mindfulness of sounds, mindfulness of breathing. You can use those practices. They're still good. But what we're going to be doing is what's called cultivating positive intention. And so we don't have to feel the compassion for it to be working. We're just planting seeds. Make sense? So just letting your body sit however your body would like to sit. Be compassionate towards your body. Don't force yourself to sit in any particular way. Finding a posture that feels good enough. Allowing the eyes to close if you like, or just letting your gaze fall down towards the floor. And to just begin taking a few deep breaths to just get your mind in line with the breathing, with the body. And as you pour the mind into the body, just saying this word internally a few times and seeing how it feels in the body. Compassion. What is compassion? Turning inward and seeing any sensations that arise in the body as you consider this word. Compassion. A deep caring for. And so using the attention to center on the general location at the heart center, so the mind doesn't wander too much. Breathing in, breathing out. Imagining that you're breathing into and out of your own heart. As you breathe in and out of the heart, just acknowledging in your own way some of the difficulties in your life, the challenges, any loss, pain, sadness, anything in your life that's been difficult, suffering. And maybe even just acknowledging in any way that it's just not been that easy of a ride. It's been hard. without getting lost in the story or the narrative, just softening into the breath, into the heart, and beginning to offer these phrases internally as you meditate. May I learn to care about the suffering and confusion in my life. Breathing that in, breathing that out. May I learn to care. May I learn to care about the suffering and confusion in my life. May I learn to respond with kindness, mercy, and empathy towards any of the suffering that I face. May I learn to respond with kindness, mercy, and empathy towards any of the suffering that I face. May I be filled with compassion. May I be filled with compassion. And may I learn to care deeply for that which hurts. May I learn to care deeply for that which hurts. We're just gently checking back into the heart, back into the breath, seeing if there's any tension or tightness in the body. And remembering this is a practice, you can't do this wrong. May I learn to care about the suffering and confusion in my life. May I learn to care about the suffering and confusion in my life. May I learn. May I learn to respond with kindness and empathy towards the suffering that I face. May I learn to respond with kindness and empathy for all of the suffering that I face. May I be filled with compassion. May I be filled with compassion. May I learn to care deeply for that which hurts. May I learn to care deeply for that which hurts. Returning to the breath, softening the heart, letting go of any tension in the body. Using whatever phrases work, keeping it simple. Breathing in, breathing out, cultivating this intention for compassion. Looking into the body. May I learn to care about this body? May I learn to care about the limitations of this body? The size, the shape, the age, the gender. The sexuality of this body. I care about this body. Sending compassion through the body as best you are able. Compassion towards the mind. I care about this mind. May I learn to care about this mind. Thoughts, plans and memories, anxiety, depression, whatever is in this mind, may I learn to care and have compassion for this mind and all the pain that comes with having a mind. I care about this mind. Breathing in, breathing out, sending compassion to the heart. May I learn to care about this heart, this fragile, vulnerable, emotional human heart, holding the heart with care. I care about this heart. Compassion in my heart. If at times it feels too much, too difficult, you can just offer the most simple of phrases. I care about you. I care about you. I care about you. Whatever's coming up right now, seeing if that can be held in compassion, if it's any pain in the body, agitation in the mind, sadness in the heart. Care about whatever's present, holding it, breathing through it, ending suffering in this moment. With compassion. and to begin spreading the compassion out throughout the room, knowing that we're all in this together. And just like me, you suffer. Just like me, may you learn to care about your pain. And so just voicing it out, setting out our own intentions, just shouting out into the room something that you care about. I care about my loneliness. Go ahead, don't be afraid. Put voice to what you care about. I care about my loneliness.
I care about my struggles.
I care about my confusion.
I care about my feelings of unworthiness.
I care about my inaptitude. I care about my self-doubt.
I care about my greed.
Say it. What are you holding on to?
I care about my fear.
I care about my sadness.
I care about my health.
I care about my craving.
I care about my impatience.
And so turning back inward and just offering compassion towards everybody who put voice towards their pain. May you be filled with compassion. May you all be filled with compassion.